Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Marta Dychok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week. Ukraine's ambassador to Canada, the Honorable Andriy Shevchenko, announced that the Canada-Ukraine Free Trade Agreement will come into effect on August the 1st. On his Facebook page, Ambassador Shevchenko wrote, "Canada gave us this present for Constitution Day. We received an official state note about the conclusion of all measures for the agreement on free trade to take force. This is a historic moment that exemplifies the colossal work of our diplomats and politicians. But it is the beginning of a much more important stage. It is time to make this agreement work through contracts, new jobs, and investments." The agreement was signed in Kyiv a year ago on July 11, 2016. It has now gone through all the ratification and approval measures on both sides and is ready to start working. The agreement cancels 98% of tariffs on Ukrainian exports to Canada and 72% of tariffs from Canada to Ukraine. This is scheduled to increase to 98% over the next 7 years. Trade between Ukraine and Canada has already been increasing. According to Ukraine's Statistical Bureau, exports from Ukraine to Canada rose by 23% in the first quarter of 2017. Canadian records showed $265 million of Canadian exports to Ukraine during the same period. Later in the show, we'll bring you a feature interview with Canada's ambassador to Ukraine on the occasion of Canada's 150th birthday celebration. The Honorable Roman Vashchuk speaks about Canada 150 and relations between Canada and Ukraine. A cyber attack hit Ukraine on Tuesday and quickly spread globally. Ukraine was hardest hit, taking the brunt of the attack, but at least 64 countries were affected. Estimates of damage are running into the tens of millions of dollars. Ukrainian politicians blamed Russia, but the Kremlin denied any responsibility, saying that their companies were also hit. International security researchers are calling this latest cyber attack a smokescreen, that its main purpose was likely to install new malware on Ukrainian government and business computers to plant the seeds for future sabotage. Others take it further and say that the extortion demands were meant to disguise a destructive, as yet unknown, motive for future in Ukraine and globally. Ukraine has been on the receiving end of two previous cyber attacks since Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. The attacks were on infrastructure, financial institutions, and power grids. Another high-level assassination happened in Kyiv on Tuesday the 27th. Colonel Maxim Shapoval, head of a Ukrainian military intelligence special forces unit, was killed by a car bomb. In 2014, Shapoval commanded the special unit that had attempted to liberate Donetsk airport, but had been working in Kyiv recently in the Ministry of Defense Chief Reconnaissance Directorate. This was the latest in a series of targeted killings that have occurred in Ukraine's capital. A year ago, journalist Pavel Sheremet was assassinated by a car bomb in central Kyiv. In March of this year, former Russian MP who had fled to Ukraine, Denis Voronikov, was gunned down in Kyiv after reportedly receiving threats from the Russian Secret Service. Shapoval was laid to rest on Friday. Poroshenko attended the official ceremony, which began at 10 a.m. at the officers' building in central Kyiv. Poroshenko said, "His death reminds us that war takes place not only on the front line, that terrorist attacks of the aggressor who come to our land with weapons can be held anywhere. I am proud of such warriors as Maxim Shapoval. May he rest in peace." Colonel Yuri Vozny of Ukraine's Secret Service was also laid to rest in the ceremony. He died on the same day as Shapoval after he tripped a mine in the village of Ilinivka in the Donbas war zone. On Friday, June the 30th, the OSCE special monitoring mission to Ukraine came under attack by anti-Ukrainian forces in the Donbas war zone. The mission continues its activities and reported a 40% intensification of hostilities over the past week. During that time, 4 Ukrainian soldiers were killed, 19 were wounded. Monday, June the 26th, was Crimean Tatar Flag Day. Both the Ukrainian and Crimean Tatar flags were raised all over Kyiv, including the office of the Mejlis, the self-governing body of the Tatars. The light blue flag with the golden Tarak Tagma symbol on the upper right corner was adopted 100 years ago by the first Kurultai Assembly, which was the self-governing body of the Crimean Tatars. The design is meant to symbolize peace, justice, goodness, unity of the people, heaven, and purity. June 26th was chosen as the official day for the flag celebration back in 2010. 2 days later, on June the 28th, was Ukrainian Constitution Day. President Poroshenko used the opportunity to once again call on Parliament to vote for constitutional amendments that would abolish immunity for members of Parliament. Poroshenko said, "High-profile cases, decisive steps to tackle corruption, which are being taken by the Prosecutor General's Office and the National Anti-Corruption Bureau, remind us all of such an anachronism as parliamentary immunity. The corresponding draft constitutional amendments have already been elaborated. I demand the members of Parliament to demonstrate their political will and become equal in rights with the citizens of Ukraine." A number of current MPs accused of corruption cannot be prosecuted because the Constitution grants immunity to all MPs from prosecution. This is a holdover from the Soviet era.
Well, there's a lot of excitement in Kyiv these days, especially this week, because it's Canada's 150th birthday. And there are all sorts of celebrations going on that kicked off last weekend, including with hockey matches in front of the City Hall in Kyiv. Well, I'm very pleased to tell you that today we have as our guest to discuss the significance of this birthday and what it means for Ukraine in particular, the ambassador of Canada to Ukraine, Roman Vaščuk. Welcome, Your Excellency.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mihailo.
Well, let's begin by asking you from a historical perspective. It's 150 years. Let's step back and look at the Canadian achievement. What, in your view, are the elements that helped the Canadian Federation to succeed and become a model for others?
I think as we look back to 1867 and actually far beyond, we have to take into account that regardless of the various imperial agendas that were in play, Canada was always a plural construct where people had to accommodate each other, and they also had to survive the winter. If we think back to Canada's Aboriginal peoples, they've been there for thousands and thousands of years, living their own lives, developing their own alliances, approach to the land. The arrival of briefly the Vikings, but then the French, with a permanent settlement, but also with a certain approach to organizing themselves, and the first also give and take with native peoples, the British and the so-called conquest in connection with the Seven Years' War, then a need to accommodate both Aboriginal peoples and the French fact in Canada, up against, as well, a rather turbulent situation next door in the U.S. with the American Revolution. As a result, Canada became the place of greatest tolerance for Catholics and French language speakers in the British Empire. It wasn't necessarily simply out of magnanimity, but in order to keep people on side as the American Revolution was ongoing, these conditions were created. And I think we've been far from perfect over the centuries and decades. The dispossession of Native peoples, and we're now working on reconciliation in light of that. The many tensions between what were known for a while as the two solitudes, English and French-speaking Canada. But overall, we have adapted to each other. We've opened up to the world. That included the late 19th century with huge waves of immigration from Europe, notably from Ukraine. And we've been trying to figure out better ways of living with each other creatively and constructively ever since.
You've succeeded as a federation. No mean achievement. I mean, when we think of the strains, Louis Riel in the uprising in the late 19th century to even events in Quebec in the 60s. But you weathered the storms and you've become an example for many other countries, including Ukraine. But you've become an example as a federation, not as a unitary state. Mm-hmm. Has that been part of the key to the success?
I think it's helped us in certain respects be more flexible, but that's the way it began. Canada in 1867, July 1st, 1867, was the amalgamation of four existing colonies, not even all the existing British colonies at the time, not all of them wanted to go along. And to keep the show on the road, you had to keep the different regions happy and give them the sense of having a voice, not only the sense, but the reality of having a voice. So we've used that to address various sensibilities. For example, I mean, I'm often asked the question, what about bilingualism? Is that an automatic model for Ukraine? And I think the answer to that is we have one form of bilingualism at the federal level, which is a citizen-centric approach that says you can ask for services in either English or French across Canada from the federal government and you are guaranteed to get them. But then also we have provinces that are equally bilingual, like New Brunswick, provinces that are fundamentally English-speaking but with French language services, like Ontario, but also Quebec, which areas of provincial jurisdiction is unilingual French, but with provision of certain public services in English as well. So we have a variety of models, and I think anyone looking at Canada has to understand that it's diverse.
Okay, Ambassador, now you yourself are of Ukrainian origin, from a Ukrainian background. How would you assess the contribution of Ukrainians in the building of Canada and shaping of its identity?
Pretty big.
They weren't simply immigrants.
Well, they were immigrants who came as pioneer settlers. They were part of not just a spontaneous bunch of people showing up. We recently had the rediscovery and rededication of the gravesite of Dr. Iosif Ulescu, a friend of Ivan Franko, an associate, who traveled to Canada in 1894-95 to scope out on a scientific basis, as well with a practical peasant counterpart, a guy named Dorunyak, on how Ukrainians could settle in the Canadian West, and wrote a book, and sort of a guide to how-to guide to settling in Canada, and people took up the opportunities. Of course, the Government of Canada, Steamship Lines, and others supported them in it. So very much the landscape of what you might call the parkland belt of Western Canada has been shaped by Ukrainian settlement. The Ukrainian churches, of course, are still very much part of the skyline in rural Western Canada.
With the occasional tree.
They didn't chop them all down.
And grain towers.
Towers, although they too are being replaced by more modern grain storage facilities, which we want to export to Ukraine as well, by the way. So yeah, I mean, now, but that's kind of the bucolic old picture of Ukrainian right. settlement. But these are now people who are provincial premiers in the recent past, who are high-tech people, who are teachers, lawyers, community activists, you know. So it's a very broadly based community and one that's really part of Canada. This is the point.
To get some perspective on the input from the Ukrainians, at their peak, what percentage of the population or proportion of the population did the Ukrainians, say, in the late 50s form? Is it true? I've heard that at one stage they were the third largest group.
They were the third largest non-Anglo, non-Franco group. Certainly they were, fifth, sixth in Canada's census list. And at that point in Canada, you couldn't list Canadian as your nationality. You can now. So Ukrainians currently, about 1.3 million people claim some Ukrainian background. Now, it could be part of multiple.
Out of a population of how many?
Of 36 million approximately. So it's more or less 3% of the Canadian population. But one of the things that people in Ukraine should remember is that there are the other 97% of my Zemlyaki, fellow Canadians. And so Canada across the country, from Newfoundland to BC, should be and is of interest to Ukrainians in all of its diversity.
Now, in the 60s, when there were these problems in Quebec, and we remember President de Gaulle talking about Vive le Québec libre and not helping matters, Pierre Elliott Trudeau managed to find a formula that worked, and it seemed that it would be based on bilingualism. But from what I recall, the Ukrainians were very instrumental in getting the concept of multiculturalism across.
In the 1960s, there was a commission that started off as the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. But people like Senator Paul Juzik, Professor Yaroslav Rudnitsky, along with representatives...
Emmanuel Lupul,
got across the point of the third factor in Canada, the non-Anglo, non-Franco groups. And this was picked up as government policy. The policy was first announced at the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress by Prime Minister Trudeau in 1971.
Yeah, I think I was there. Winnipeg, yeah?
Winnipeg, indeed. So it's certainly a major contribution to that initial phase of institutionalized Canadian multiculturalism. It's evolved considerably ever since. There have been many waves of immigration since. The face of Canada is one that is constantly changing. But people of Ukrainian origin, along with those of Somali origin, of Syrian origin,
Chinese, Indian,
exactly,
Vietnamese,
are very much part of the scene.
Yes. Okay. Let's focus on the present and the present challenges and prospects. I think many people in Ukraine and in the diaspora and those who follow Ukraine will recall the very strong support that Canada provided both under the Harper government and now under the Trudeau government of Trudeau Jr., if I can refer to him as that, to Ukraine after or during Maidan and during the Revolution of Dignity. But is the Canada-Ukraine thing just a sentimental diaspora-motivated driven connection, or is there more meat to it?
No, I think it's about much more than that. Certainly since Maidan, it's also been about small-L liberal democracy and versus authoritarianism, both in terms of the domestic scene in Ukraine and the confrontation with an authoritarian regime in Ukraine's biggest neighbor. It's also about middle powers, and Ukraine is globally a middle power, as is Canada, count on a rules-based regime and the fact that some big country can't just come along and take a chunk of your territory. Quite apart from the morality or immorality of it, every medium-sized country has a visceral interest in Ukraine's territorial integrity being respected and restored. And if you look at the overall Euro-Atlantic space, Canadians have fought in two world wars to maintain the integrity of that space. We're still involved in NATO and, for example, Canadian troops leading the forward presence in Latvia, very much playing an active role in the OSCE as well. So to maintain the integrity of that space, for which we have sacrificed a lot in the 20th century, helping Ukraine defend itself is also part of that.
So looking at the Canadian-Ukrainian relationship, especially at how it's developed over the last 25 years or so since independence, compared to, say, 20 years ago, it's not simply, we see now, it's not simply Ottawa that's involved. There is much more involvement at various institutions, provincial levels, regionally, etc. Would you agree?
Definitely. And I'd say, unsurprisingly, it's a more mature relationship, but also that it has more depth. We are engaged now in things such as gender in policing, areas such as training of non-commissioned personnel, sergeants in the Ukrainian armed forces. The levels of confidence have increased to the extent that we can get in under the hood, as we'd say in Canada, and help Ukrainians fix some of the things that they feel need fixing about their country. We also have new regions that have become engaged. One of the most active provinces here in Ukraine is New Brunswick. Partly it's recruiting for education, recruiting for migration, but also as platforms for business. Canada's main exports last year into Ukraine came from Quebec and British Columbia. British Columbia coal and Quebec fish. So it isn't just the usual suspects.
No, fascinating.
Ontario, the prairies. There's lots of opportunity. This is why I say people should look at a map of all of Canada, not just the Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal triangle, or traditional areas of interest.
Okay, now let's focus on the very latest and important developments. So, a free trade agreement has been signed, and it starts imminently on the 1st of August. Can you just remind our listeners about the main elements, the main components?
Pretty easy. 99.9% of Ukrainian products enter Canada duty, tariff, and quota-free. It's about 87% going the other way. So this is an agreement designed to give Ukraine a running start. We've also put together a Canada-Ukraine Trade and Investment Support Project, $13 million Canadian dollars over 5 years to identify priority sectors, build the capacity of the Ukrainian economy ministry to develop an export strategy for North America and the world to help move Ukrainian product and services globally, and then also to support Canadian incoming investment into Ukraine. So yesterday I was meeting with a Ukrainian pet food manufacturer who was asking me, what do I think are the prospects for getting into the Canadian market? And judging by their reasonably up-to-date production facilities, the fact that they've got certification for the EU, the fact that they understand how to potentially produce private labels, I think I told him his chances aren't too bad. Definitely should look into things. We've got Ukrainian companies that have made breakthroughs into, let's say, the Canadian fruit juice market, companies that sell electronic components into Canada. And of course, then we've been this week showcasing Canadian stuff that you can buy in Ukraine.
Right. Okay. This all sounds great. Skeptics would say, but how do we make this free trade agreement operational in conditions where we've not had an entirely encouraging experience over the last 20 years? And the enduring problem of oligarchic controls.
I think getting hung up on important, unsolved, but not determinant macro problems shouldn't mean that you don't work on any of the micro. Anyone who's been to Ocean Plaza or an epicenter here in Ukraine knows that there's more people out there shopping than three oligarchs.
These are major shopping centers in the center of Kyiv, I just want to emphasize. But Ambassador, it's your support from Canada is not simply in the areas of trade and it's about liberalizing the system generally, democratization. You're not only supportive, as we notice, to Ukraine's defense of its territory and integrity, but you are also active in capacity building in terms of civil society development, broadening democratization and whatnot. What are you involved in most recently in those spheres?
Well, I think we've been working a lot on electoral access and reform, greater engagement by women, by disabled people into the electoral process. We've been working on gender issues more broadly, now working with Deputy Prime Minister Klimpush. And I think she was your guest a couple of weeks ago talking about her new role as gender commissioner. And we've got a project with UN Women that supports her in making a new push to mainstream women's rights in Ukraine. We've got local government projects developing 16 city strategies for towns in four oblasts across Ukraine, but trying to do it in ways that people can see. And picking up on trends that are happening in Ukraine anyway. So we're trying to kind of, I'm not saying we're going with the flow here, but we're trying to be partnering with Ukrainians and not just lecture them, but help them achieve what they want to achieve.
Okay, look, let's just quickly also touch on an issue of considerable interest for Ukrainians here, and that is lifting the visa requirements. Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau has just said that it's still not quite time for this. So I'd like to ask you, what would be the conditions in which Canada would be ready to lift these visa restrictions as the EU has just done?
Right. Well, Canada makes its decisions based on our both border and domestic migration legislation. And it's pretty generous once you get to Canada. So we're pretty careful about who gets on the plane and makes it to Canada. And secondly, the migration pressures that drive the behavior of people in various countries, including Ukraine. So I think we will be watching carefully and with great interest how the visa-free regime with the EU works out. And it seems to be working out very well in the initial weeks and month, and see what impact that has on, you know, the extent to which a Ukrainian tourist is actually a tourist and not a potential worker. The tendency to come and return as opposed to stay. All of these are factors that are part of our decision making. I think we are seeing a better traveled Ukrainian society. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to make progress, but that'll be according to Canadian, not EU or anybody else's criteria.
Okay, last but not least, tell us a little bit about this week's celebrations of 150 years of Canada in Ukraine.
Sure. Yeah, we had, as you mentioned, our hockey afternoon or hockey day on Khrushchatyk. 10 teams and several thousand people who came through to watch and take part. And we had Bombardier Recreational Products with their various 4x4 and motorcycle fun machines. We had our retail display in Tsum, which is still ongoing.
It's the central department store.
Yes, here in Kyiv. And all of that also then working up to a reception, a sort of an invitation-only reception we'll be having at on the grounds of St. Sophia on Friday night, the 30th. So we'll be sharing some of our Canadian music there. There's a band coming from Winnipeg called Royal Canoe. They'll also be taking part in the Atlas Weekend Festival, which is a rock and pop festival here in Kyiv. But before that, we took part in a Francophone street fair earlier this month. We've opened a display, which is still on Sophia Square, about Canada's role in welcoming refugees through history with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR. So we've tried to, you know, portray the serious, the policy-oriented, the sports, the fun, the cultural aspects of Canada, well, a bit of culinary aspects as well.
Thank you. Again, I've been talking to Roman Vaschuk, Canada's ambassador to Ukraine, on the occasion of the 150th anniversary of Canada. Thank you.
This week saw the annual Alpha Jazz Festival taking place in Lviv. Growing with every year, it's now a 5-day event which brings together international big-name jazz musicians and emerging and known Ukraine talent. There were about 30 different groups performing on 3 main stages. Ticketed main entry stage sold out every time, estimated at about 18,000 tickets. Listeners could enjoy pure jazz, Latin, funk, or rock, and listen to styles of music both new and familiar to them. The Lviv Alpha Jazz Festival has become a place to see and be seen, a meeting place for Ukraine's politicians and business community. With all the visitors flocking from all over Ukraine, Lviv hotels and restaurants enjoyed the results of full-to-capacity week. Next week, I'll be hosting the show, bringing you an overview of the news in Ukraine, international news, and a feature interview. Tune in for a new episode. and we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.